Thomas Brillig and the hoser banded gyre and jimble and a muse, all mimsy tunes from Newfieland, and tipped their tom-toms to the muse. Beware the oak-pick bird, my son, his eyes so big and head so cold. Beware the vorpal-bladed nun, his consort from the wold.
There was once an Eskimo handicraft toy called an ookpick, which is Inuit for souvenir with beak. And how is it that the souvenir is singing O Canada? Did you hear that little excerpt of O Canada that it's singing?
You noticed that.
I did.
It just might have been.
Meanwhile, it was a four-dimensional reproduction of a snowy owl that was anatomically correct right down to its dodecahedral talons and adobe hairpiece. The first ookpick dates from 1964, a Saturday, and was the product of a young musical shaman named Bino Benghazi.
Bino!
Benghazi had been under house arrest at the Fort Hoser... I don't know that I can do it. That is very disconcerting. Benghazi had been under house arrest at the Fort Hoser Eskimo Cooperative at Tuktoyaktuk for his part in a critically vilified production of West Side Story. He had cast the characters in the most literal way, substituting real carnivorous fish for the sharks and a pair of two-thirds scale X-15 rocket-powered aircraft for the jets. It was an enormously expensive undertaking, and the production company declared bankruptcy mere minutes after the curtain fell on the premiere performance.
It fell on the premiere performance.
Right on it, smack dab.
I see. And the sharks were laid waste, and the jets exploded.
Well, and that's not part of the story.
What about Officer Krupke?
Oh, well...
Did he go out and have a donut? All right.
Maybe he had an owl. I don't know that
owl.
Part. Anyway, Oh, there it is again.
No, it's a different one.
Oh, okay.
It will all come clear.
No
soon
doubt.
Enough. Well, the curtain was falling.
Down.
On the top.
Members of a collection agency straightaway collected Benghazi and locked him in a storeroom on the cooperative's top floor as collateral. But the shaman well knew about collateral damage due to a string of accidents that accompanied his early sorcerous activities, so he further realized that he needed to escape. The storeroom was awash in rope ladders, pneumatic drills, even a small helicopter. But Bino preferred to absquatulate on his own terms, so he gathered up the random scraps of sealskin, a prosthetic owl beak, an animatronic apparatus, and a needle and haystack. Then he set to work to construct a proper escape vehicle.
There's no sound effect for a needle in a haystack unless you stick yourself with it.
Well, what are we waiting for?
Ah!
There we are. Within an hour, he had it, a quasi-adorable bird of prey that measured nearly 4 meters from its talons to its hairpiece. Bino! Rolled it to the window, hopped into its pouch, and popped the clutch. The bird's wings unfurled grandly as it stepped off the sill. Unfortunately, Bino had attached the wings backwards, so the Bernoulli effect was nullified. The good news is that his extensive use of sealskin resulted in a lighter-than-air craft, so he floated to freedom, and in time, to a lucrative entrepreneurial career in ookpick sales and service. Because when youngsters saw the great totem hovering in the sky over Tuktoyaktuk, they naturally wanted one, too.
Bino
was happy to oblige, and grubstaked by the collection agency, he was soon producing miniature versions of his lighter-than-air birdcraft at the rate of 4 dozen a day. Orders continued to pour in, so Bino was forced to take on an apprentice. And that was the beginning of the trouble. The apprentice was a wax-lipped nun named Sister Beadle, of the religious order of Vorpal Blades, and she was more than a bit odd, even to a guy who co-opted the supernatural for a living. Little was known of the ROVB, save that its members were said to transcend the traditional boundary between incorporeality and the material world. On her employmental application, the nun wrote,
Brillig.
Under references,
Mimsy.
For positions previously held, and
Far Out in the Wold.
For mailing address. But she bore an uncanny resemblance to a 1950 Hudson wingback, and Bino liked her for that.
Bino!
So he hired her. Initially, the nun's work was swift and confident. She assembled ookpicks at the astonishing rate of 14 per hour, more than double Bino's best pace.
Bino's best pace.
Plus, she skillfully concealed the stitching in the fourth dimension, so the outer surface of the bird was seamless. Bino felt comfortable with leaving her unsupervised so he could focus on West Side Story revisions. I suppose you have any West Side Story revisions in there.
I didn't bring any along with me other than maybe, I feel pretty, oh so pretty. But it didn't work that way.
Yeah.
He had to go back to the original.
Yeah. But then, Sister Beetle's Vorpal Blade Syndrome kicked in and she began to alter the dolls. First, she glazed the hair pieces with protactinium, which lowered the temperature of the Ookpick's head by 250 degrees. Then she placed a gyre into the beak, a gimbal in each talon, and a tum-tum in its belly while mumbling a Vorpal incantation. Oh, is that it? And suddenly, the character of the Ookpick changed forever. The erstwhile warm and fuzzy souvenir with beak had developed an appetite for human blood. Not surprisingly, sales plummeted. Not even a triple order.
Plummeted.
Oh, plummeted, yes, of course. Not even a triple order from the religious order of Vorpal Blades could keep Ookpick Me Up Limited out of the blood red. The company folded, and only the purchase of Bino's original animatronic Ookpick by an anonymous collector for a large sum allowed him to pay off his creditors and stay out of the hoosegow. Still, he was asked to vacate to Tayuktuk, and he was last seen heading in the opposite direction of Sister Beetle, who was fading in and out of focus en route to her end of the world. Today, the Ookpick has new life. No longer solely the realm of the souvenir with beak, it now enjoys limited appeal amongst a group of music aficionados. Or one, anyway. But one who, coincidentally, is
in the house
of Calvus and Damien this very day. I mean, you couldn't write a happenstance like that. You could. But only if you had the key that unlocked the door that allowed you to come, chaperone or no.
In the house.
You may be wondering.
I am. You got some splaining to do there, bucko.
Well, the Ookpick, as we all know now.
We do.
Is the snowy owl.
Yes.
Which I did not know at the time we began this interview sequence.
Yeah.
I thought, what could it be? What could an Ookpick be? And I looked it up, and sure enough, it was. And so I looked further. Until I could find...
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Danger, I find the call of the snowy owl.
Ah.
To which we must thank John Neville of his Bird Songs of the Arctic Along the Dempster Highway CD, available at CD Baby. Thank you, John Neville. And, of course, with just five little calls, we have this piece you're listening to now, Cap'n Hookpick.
And did I really hear the theme from O Canada, or was that just my mind playing?
It was your mind playing tricks. Yes, it was. Hmm. Because there was nothing more than a rising root fifth octave.
That's a root canal fifth.
Followed by a very low note.
Hmm.
But it just sort of gave the illusion of it being something real.
Oh, yeah.
Other than that, yes, there was a whole series of stuff going on. It was actually a mélange of two previous compositions of mine with their MIDI background pieces re-rendered as... Uktiks.
So how do you register that with ASCAP?
I don't, because it's not by me.
Oh,
it's right. By something else.
Oh, I
it's
see.
By Captain Uktik or something. I
okay,
don't know.
Then ASCAP didn't hear what we just said.
Exactly.
Who? Yeah, of course. Meanwhile,
I think we must begin our work. Oh, I should also mention that aside from Captain Uktik, we also had an excerpt from Amongst Nothing But Butterflies and Clouds, in case you wondered where that barred owl came from and all of that.
Is that what that was?
Yes, that was from music by Lisa Whistlecroft, an upcoming guest on Calvos and Damien.
Yes.
Yes!
One who is yet to provide a really substantial biography.
Biography, yes. Right. Well, her name is longer than her bio, then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's turn down all this and move directly into our inquisitive zone.
Yes, and this concerns... there is a reference to Uktik, I believe, in the interview to be.
Right at the beginning.
Excellent. Well, we hope you're using the latest technology. We're using a cassette here.
We are using... No, we're using 78 RPM records.
Okay, that's why the those Canadians, they work in what? Celsius?
They work in Celsius telephones.
So things are slower up there, or
okay.
Out there.
They're slower up there. I was being a little slow because I was just trying to figure out the logistics of having the headphone on one ear and the... Not that I actually need to monitor myself when I'm talking.
Certainly not. We will monitor for you.
I'm just being...
So you have up on your screen a... Is that a photo montage of Alex? It looks odd.
No, it's just a little Canadian flag superimposed on a telephone.
Oh, all right.
That's what it shows here on the Skype thing. Our guest today on Calvos and Damien
in the house
is Alex Olson, also known as Alex Uktik, which my research tells me is that snowy owl that we can find in the native stores occasionally. Is that true?
It is.
Funny,
it's
my...
Actually... go ahead.
What? No, you go ahead. Then I'll break in.
I was going to say, it's the Inuit word for snowy owl. But then, at a certain point in Canadian history, it also sort of was thrust upon the Canadian public as some kind of logo or mascot for Canada. And I guess around sometime in my childhood, they started making little dolls, little Uktik dolls. So Uktiks have been in my life since I was a kid, and that's sort of where the inspiration comes from.
So you're a mascot now?
No, it's more just sort of feeling the link to owls, and there's something sort of wise and magical and sort of playful at the same time about the image of an Uktik for me, for some reason.
And there's all that plumage. We've seen some of the photos on your MySpace page. And
that's velour.
Was that velour?
Yeah.
I thought it was all right, I can't tell the difference. Plumage and velour, there's quite a similarity.
You remember the Velveteen Rabbit? Well, this is the Velveteen Uktik.
Ah, I see. Yes. And also the early American author Louisa May Alcott, who wrote about owls. Is that correct?
Oh, certainly, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to the serious stuff. Alex, welcome to the show, and tell us about yourself. You sent us an extended bio, and extended was indeed the word.
It was
some 3 pages of extended bio. For a person who's relatively young, you've done an awful lot. Tell us how you got into the world of composition. How did you get there?
Well, I guess, you know, like a lot of musicians, it was a journey that started when I was young, you know, just wanting to sing and record things and stuff like that. And I did even then take it pretty seriously, even though I was probably writing silly little pop songs or something. But, Yeah, and then you know, later on, well, I guess when I was 18, I, you know, had a band and was co-writing with someone, and it was just the dynamic we had that he would write the music first, and then I would add the vocal parts. So I just sort of never questioned that and just kind of respected that dynamic, which was, you know, it worked for what we were doing. But once that band dissolved, I just was left with, you know, left to my own devices. And it really, that and I guess having, studied electroacoustics and done some composition then, and also, I guess, just the availability of recording technology, because when I'd finished electroacoustics, I didn't have money to have any kind of studio set up. And for me, that's a big part of writing. So it just sort of all came together, and I just started, you know, experimenting and writing and putting things together. And it's just sort of feels like it's grown exponentially from there. So
you did have a musical childhood, though. You apparently were surrounded by all sorts of interesting music.
Owls.
I did.
One that you mentioned is Owlis Coltrane, isn't it?
Well, she's a funny thing because my brother is also a musician, and he somehow we're talking about music, and we both sort of realized that in a way, subconsciously, we're trying to unite the musical taste of our mother and father, which is my dad was into classical, but, you know, romantic, and then 20th century, and then more experimental stuff, and my mom was really into jazz and funk and soul, and so it's sort of a joke with my brother and I that we're trying to unite those two styles. And although neither of my parents were musicians, my dad was, I'd say, you know, obsessive music fan. He actually ended up teaching, just an evening course on classical music appreciation eventually at some point. And, you take it for granted as a kid. And, and, you know, it's not a concrete thing like, oh, my father was, concert pianist or something. But looking back and just speaking to other musicians, it is, I guess, quite a lot of music to grow up with. So, yeah. So, I feel thankful to have that. I guess it's
Let's talk about this band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's talk. Well, as a matter of fact, I had asked if you could send us something that was not your top flight work, and it turns out that delving back into your history is the perfect opportunity to do a little bit of that. So, tell us about the band, how it got its name, and about the title track that we will hear shortly.
Sure. Well, Marlowe was a band that started around the time when I was about 18. I met a group of musicians who had been playing together in high school, but wanted to sort of take a new direction with things and get a new singer. And so I started working with them, and, we made a first album, and that went okay. We're very slow at making records, partly because of perfectionism in recording and writing, which, you know, can be good, but... this song title track is from, I guess it's our second record. It came out in 2003, although I guess we technically launched it in 2004, but a lot of the stuff, because of the slow process, had been written, you know, years before that even. It's a neat band, actually. We had a lot of neat stuff going on there, and I'd say that, you know, broadly, people would say we were post-rock, whatever that means.
What does that mean? I was wondering, you had made some mention of that.
I guess it sort of means taking the conventions of rock and turning them on their heads, getting away from traditional song structure, maybe into almost a sort of orchestral feeling, although still with the same basic rock instruments, drum, bass, guitar, vocals. Maybe adding other instruments and, you know, more experimental sensibility to it. This song I'm actually quite proud of. I feel, you know, we really explored different structures of songwriting, and in a way had, you know, I feel this song has some influence of maybe Steve Reich, things like that in there, although it's, you know, within a rock-ish kind of setting. So, yeah, I am proud of it. The one thing that I am not so happy about looking back on it is just the vocals. when you're younger, you sort of, sometimes you...
Let's hear it.
Yeah.
Our guest is Alex Olson.
Okay.
And I'm not sure why you were dissatisfied with it. It's actually quite a mysterious kind of a track in some ways.
But there's the vocal. Was low.
Yes. Yeah, the vocal is a little low. And, you know, as a singer, I think you go through a bit of a journey on a certain level and, you know, of discovering your own voice. And I would say that, you know, the people that you're playing with at the time sort of shape that. You know, and even in the way that someone that in our everyday lives, we kind of change our voice depending on who we're talking to. As a singer, you sort of do that too, at least I did back then. And so I just feel that I'm singing in a very small way in that piece. So now with newer stuff that I'm doing, I'm trying to just, you know, be more natural with it. So listening back, it's, you know, you just sort of hear what, you know, the changes from the past to the present, you know. So I guess that's my critical take on that. But maybe it's more of a personal thing then. I don't know.
Let's turn to the first piece of yours that I heard, and probably the reason that I got in touch with you, or actually got in touch with me and invited us to listen, but that was the piece that said, okay, let's talk to our guest today, Alex Olson, and that was Sad Machines.
Right.
We're going to play it, but something about how it came about, and it's a captivating kind of a piece, and what were you after with it?
Well, that was actually the first piece I wrote after, you know, when I started starting out writing on my own. And like a lot of my stuff, some of it's just based on improvisation. And it's just sort of, I guess it came about from writing from my gut and just sort of a lot of my work. Starts out by me sitting down at my keyboard, actually, my synthesizer, which is analog, and just kind of, because there's no presets on it, just sort of playing with things and shaping some sounds. And so it really started from that strange bass sound, bass synth sound, and the sort of pitch bend of that. And I guess in a way it's sort of a bit of a 12-bar blues kind of thing.
Well, I was thinking that it had a really kind of a disguised pop to it.
Yes.
And were you going for that kind of disguise? Was that sort of on your mind, or did it just happen?
Well, actually, you know, leading up to writing that, and even when my band was still together, I had started in my mind shaping, let's say, the starting point for some songs. And I guess that was just a palette, a musical palette of different instruments. I have a glockenspiel and a ukulele and my synthesizer. And so I guess in a way that those deciding to just work with those particular instruments and voice, of course, kind of shapes the songs, and I guess part of my intention there was to get away from that structure of the, you know, the rock band and all that, and try to still use the sensibility of writing, well, quote unquote, a pop song, but with just different instruments, with a different palette, sort of,
yeah,
you know,
really big air quotes around that pop song, though.
Yes. Well, sorry, go ahead.
When we come back, we're going to listen to it. When we come back, I want to ask you how you go about actually making it. What do you do? What's the actual process you go through? So we'll listen to it now. This is Sad Machines. Our guest is Alex Olson.
Thank you.
Sad Machines by Alex Olson. Damien, you have some questions?
No. I mean, maybe.
Get some questions.
Oh.
Because we're going to ask her how she put this together, and I'm sure you want to know.
No, I was just sitting back here listening.
Being sad?
No, I'm listening.
Being mechanical?
I'm watching the clowns go by. I'm wondering if there are any different up in Canada.
The clowns?
Clowns and clouds. There is a definitely definite clown component to your music.
Oh, what?
Yes, didn't you hear it?
You're talking to me?
No. That
clown component?
Yes. Don't you sense it?
I think cloud was the word you were looking for.
Cloud or clown, that's the same to me. You don't sense it in your music? There's no big...
A clown component?
Yes.
What type of clown? An evil clown?
A sad clown.
A sad clown.
Of course. Clowns on velvet with big eyes. Sad clowns.
Oh, boy.
You don't sense that?
Specifically with this song or just in general?
With this general song.
I think we're losing ground here. Let's go back to how you made this. Come on,
I've tried my darndest to think about it that way, but I can't. No.
Could you elaborate? No, I can't. No, you're the elaborator. We just question. We put the questions to you, and then you respond to the queries.
Well,
so
okay,
put down
there
that
is.
Battery.
Okay, I can maybe think of one clown-like association or something similar to that. Maybe some of my songs, the lyrics and the tone of them, although, you know, well, this one obviously has a sad tone to it. I've always loved the writing. I've always loved jazz standards. Jazz standards by Cole Porter,
Steve Reich,
songs. Sorry,
Paulina Oliveros.
Yeah, songs sung by Billie Holiday. And part of what I've loved about that and blues is the sort of saying something that's very sad, but at the same time poking fun at yourself about it, and sort of. Through singing about something sad, you sort of make it less sad. And so in a way, there's sort of... Some of my songs have a sort of, for lack of a better way of describing it, sort of cute monster way about them, that it's sort of like there's something sort of ugly or maybe sad about them. But at the same time, there's sort of a playfulness to that. There's sort of a melodrama. The sort of knowing melodrama to it, so.
And that's the insane clown component.
The insane, yes. Yes, I'm very influenced by Insane Clown Posse.
There we go.
Yes.
And if we can get back to the question that I asked before we actually heard it, which is how you made the piece. Do you actually score this? Do you improvise and loop? How do you put it together? What's the studio technique you use?
A lot of my compositions are based on improvisations, and the dynamic that through recording an improvisation, you can sort of freeze it in time, and take that material and then decide what part of it you like, what part of it you want to use, and then yes, you can loop it. A lot of people write loop-based music, and the loop is always the same. One thing that I like to play with is taking something that is a loop, but playing it all the way through, so that it has that naturalness to it, that human variation. Sort of switching back and forth between those things. So, Sad Machines does have a loop, the bass part, but it's a loop of a played loop. For lack of a better way to describe it. So the sequence of the notes is played, and it's an improvisation, and then that is taken, that chunk is taken and pasted across the song. And then on top of it are the other layers, and I just sort of write as I go. So it's sort of like, you know, making a stir fry. You sort of, you know, put the onions in, and then you're going to be adding... the zucchini or whatever it is, and so those things are just written listening to the first track that I wrote, and then it's sort of this additive process.
Now, the stir fry, of course, you can't take anything out.
No.
Do you build on what you do and keep everything, or do you find yourself stripping out tracks as you go along?
Well, in some of my more recent songs that I've been working on, I have been doing more of that, more, let's say, arranging after the fact, more taking a track out in certain parts, putting it back in. But one thing I wanted to get away from in a lot of my music is overthinking things. And actually, it's strange to admit, but Sad Machines, the vocal track in it, is not a take. It's actually me writing the song. I tried to do other takes of it, but none of them ever captured the same spirit of the vocal track from when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. So basically, I had the synthesizer line there. You know, it was late at night. I wrote it, and then I sang the vocal melody over it and the words, improvising it. And it's never been able to be replaced, and it has some imperfections to it, but I feel like leaving those in is worth it to have that, to capture the moment. So
maybe that's what gives it the strength. There's the philosophy that your first guess is the one that is the one you should go with, and your first inspiration is the one you should keep. And then if you overthink it, as you say, then it will fail.
That's it.
Let's go to voice study. What were you studying with this? What is the character of the study? We'll listen to it in just a second, but maybe give us a little prep for it.
Well, it's really an exploration of an it's an electroacoustics piece, and it was written in the spirit of electroacoustics. But I guess one thing that I find interesting about electroacoustics is a lot of the compositional tools of that have to do with gesture, and making gestures with sounds, found sounds, and the way you process them. And at the time I had access to a vocoder, and I sort of felt that why not use the voice as my sound source and see what kind of shape it could take through the vocoder, and make a piece from that, and have the gestures be vocal, because the voice is such a flexible instrument, and so that's basically what it is the gestures are coming from the sound source of the voice, and then the shapes that it takes are through the vocoder, or different ways that I tweaked that, and so. That's basically the idea behind it.
Our guest is Alex Olson. This is Voice Study.